Chapter 11 of Greengrey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This legamous recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. It'll be Christmas week. The annual change in the solemn, plodding homesteaders will have set in strong. They'll be making special trips to the township to buy a few little extra things, and some will take their wives and families with them, though most times it will be the wives who will take the husbands. You yourself, though still a bachelor doing your own bit of washing and cooking and sweeping out, will trot along like the rest for a pound or two of raisins to try your hand on a pudding, and perhaps you'll plunge on a hat and a couple of flannels as well. And what a bureau of information the store will be to the lot of you. "Do you know who's come home for Christmas?" you'll hear from the bustling storekeeper as you step on the veranda and reach the door. But before he can get any further, his wife, who is at the other end of the counter, helping in the rush, will broadcast, "Willie Hagen and the two McNamaras."
"And is it true?"
the oldest customer will ask as he squeezes one of his feet into a new blucher.
"That Sam Telford is back after being in the Never Never for 15 or 20 years.
"That's so," the storekeeper, scooping currants out of a bin for Mrs. Flynn, will proclaim. "He came back a day or two ago." Then there'll be a pause to place the currants on the scales, and in the pause Mrs. Storekeeper will take up Sam Telford and give full details of his arrival, adding that "he's going to stay at Rudd's place, so they told us." Mention of Sam Telford will almost take your breath away. "What's that?" you'll ask, pushing your way in among the women and kids. "You mean Sam Telford, whose father was killed by the blacks?"
"The same," proudly from the storekeeper, as he squints closely at the scales for the third or fourth time. "And a smart-looking man he's turned out, too,"
will come from Mrs. Storekeeper, for the benefit of the lady customers.
"With his beard and strapped trousers, though he must be middle-aged now."
"Sam Telford back, eh?" you'll smile, letting the raisins and the hat and flannels slip out of your head. "Me and him were pals for years out on the Warrego and the Cooper. Gad, I must see old Sam before he's off again, wherever he is."
"You'll see him, Dick,"
the storekeeper, taking back a few more of Mrs. Flynn's currants to make the load lighter for her to carry, will assure you.
"He's sure to be in here again with some of the Rudds. We'll tell him about you and where your place is."
"And tell him I've got whips of room for him," you'll say, and out you'll stride as if you've finished your shopping. But before reaching your horse you'll stop abruptly and return with a foolish-looking grin on your face. It'll be Christmas Eve now. Having had your dinner you'll be standing in the doorway, filling your pipe. The rubbish lying about will catch your eye and start you wondering if it wouldn't be as well to clean it up and make the place look a bit tidy, in case you might have a visitor or two. The thought has scarcely entered your head when you'll realize that three horsemen have entered the gate and are almost at your door. How on earth you didn't see them sooner has got you beat. And while you're feeling puzzled, two of them, one a boy, will greet you mirthfully, the first addressing you as Dick, the other as Richard. The third will regard you with twinkling eyes and a broad smile. In an instant, of course, you'll recognize Dave and Joe Rudd, though you will have seen little of them for over a year.
"Don't you know who this bloke is, Dick?"
Dave will ask, pointing proudly to Sam Telford as they all dismount.
"We've brought him over to see you and to have afternoon tea, Dick,"
Joel stutter with even more pride than Dave, for they'll both be in charge of the line.
"Sam!" you'll exclaim proudly, and bounding from the veranda you'll grab his hand and he'll grab yours.
Then, looking you up and down, he'll reckon you haven't altered a darn bit.
"Neither of you, Sam, hanged if you have." And your eyes, and his too, will sparkle with the light of old friendship brought to mind.
Leading the way, you'll invite him into the castle. Dave and Joe will require no invitation. "And tell us what you've been doing since that Christmas, how many years ago, when we parted out on Maguire's old cattle station."
"About 17, Sam will remember. "I say, Dick," Joe will break in, "them hens of yours has been eating pumpkin seed. Why? You ask indifferently, looking at the fowls that are dodging about. What makes you think that, Joe? Be the way they lean back when they walk and shove their hind part along like penguins.
Like your grandmother, Dave will guffer at his young brother.
They won't lay any more eggs for you, Dick.
Joe, ignoring Dave, will persist as they step onto the veranda.
Unless you give them plenty of salts.
Was that what they used to give them to you for? Dave will guffer again, and Sam and you will break into mirth as you enter the castle. You're surprised, I suppose, Sam, you'll begin, dragging the chairs together, to find I've turned out a cocky. But tell us something about the West. I suppose if a fellow like me was taken there now, blindfold and let go, he wouldn't know where he was. And how did old Maguire get on? Make his pile?
Oh, the old man passed out long ago, Dick. Sam, who's a good talker and no ordinary bushman, will answer as he rests the left boot on his right knee and toys with the rowel of his spur. Fay, the daughter, you remember her, came in for everything when he died, and took over the station herself, and managed it splendidly, too. You look surprised that a bit of a girl, as she'll appear to your mind, could run a large cattle station, a job that lots of men wouldn't tackle.
A girl managing a station? Dave will grin doubtingly. Cripes, there must be a lot of the man in her.
No, Sam will answer quietly. A fine-looking girl she is, very tall, a great horsewoman, very game, very determined, and quite at home day or night in any part of the bush. Very few men better than her.
And how big is this station, Sam? Joe will want to know. And how many cattle has she got on it?
Well, I suppose you could ride in a straight line for 100 miles or so without crossing the boundary of it, he'll be told.
What? From Joe. 100 mile?
Ghost, Dave will add. And about 20,000 head of cattle when I was there. But for a while she lost some big mobs. A couple of gentlemen, buyers, used to call and take 100 or so off her hands at her own price, and hand them over to their men, staying overnight themselves, playing and singing songs, while a second lot of men moved off with 1,000 head or so, keeping in the tracks of the others, but travelling by night.
"Hokey!"
Dave will gasp, leaning across the table, while Joe will echo,
"1,000?"
The time came, though. Sam will pause to put down his foot and stretch out his two long bow legs in comfort, when she got even with them.
"What did she do, Sam?"
from Joe.
"Lay a trap for them?" from Dave.
"Well, this is one instance. I was up to my eyes in it with her, as it happened."
"Cripes! He never told us this one before," Dave will gush in anticipation.
Then Sam will lean forward, press his palms down hard on his thighs, and with eyes opening wide and glistening like the leaves of the myall in a sun-shower, will proceed, "We were mustering on the western side along Boomerang Creek. You remember it, Dick?" You'll nod, of course, whether you remember it or not. There was Fitzmaurice, the head stockman. Gongula, a half-caste reared on the station. Fay Maguire, and yours truly. Fay was riding her grey mare, Britta Marte, a splendid beast among stock. In fact, we were all mounted on the station's best. "I reckon you would be, Sam," you'll break in reminiscently, your eyes starting to light up, as in fancy you see and scent the mobs and the mulga. "But the old place never had a bad horse on it. As a rule, we could muster a couple of 1,000 head of cattle at that end of the run, but this time we hadn't been a couple of hours on the creek when Gongula, with a shake of his head, decided, 'No cattle been running here for a long time.' I agreed with him,
but Fitzmaurice kept a still tongue. So we worked Boomerang Creek the whole of that day, only coming across about 100 head, and made the old hut out there our headquarters.
"And did the girl,"
Dave will put in with a curious grin, "camp with all you blokes?"
"Safety in numbers, Dave," Sam will answer. "Besides, Gongula took care of her. Well, next day we came across some tracks way up the river. At first only an odd one or two, stragglers, but further along we got on the tracks of a mob. They came out of a belt of mulga, swam the river, crossed the boundary, and headed due west. As it happened, we were all together, having made the spot where we picked up the first tracks our meeting-place. The time would be about noon. As each of us rode studying those tracks in silence, our thoughts all ran in the one direction. For there it was written on the ground, as plain as if it was printed on paper, that a mixed mob of at least 1,000 head had been driven off the run, and driven by 5 horsemen, 2 of them on short horses."
"Holy, eh?"
And Dave will gape open-mouthed. "Gone about 3 days," Gongula said, as we all came together again. For a few moments we just sat in our saddles, looking at one another.
"What do you want us to do, Miss McGuire?" Fitzmaurice asked at last, speaking slowly, while he dragged hairs from his horse's mane.
"To follow them up as fast as we can, of course," she answered sharply. And when we caught the look that flashed from her eyes, we knew that she meant it too, woman or no woman.
"Not much use rushing after them now, when they've got 3 days' start," he demurred. "There's no cattle country to the west of here that I know of, and you'll find those tracks will swing right south before going far, and get lost in the lagoon country."
"That will be for us to find out," she answered. "Now hurry, man, get the spare horses and packs, and we'll follow them."
"And she was a woman, was she?"
Joe will stutter in astonishment, to which Dave will answer, "You don't think she was a man, do you?"
"No," from Joe again. "And I don't think you are either, Dave."
In less than a couple of hours we were on those tracks again, trailing them at a fair pace with our faces to the west, Gongula leading the way. I can see him now as plain as I can see him then, leaning over his horse's shoulder, his eyes scanning the ground, while his silence made him seem uncanny. Towards nightfall those tracks increased, showing another mob had joined in. The grass and herbage became scarcer, and the water we came to was only soakage. Gongula at intervals would turn his head to tell us it was right, but Fitzmaurice all the time was troubled with doubts.
"What was that you said, Sam?"
Joe, not understanding, will inquire. Sam will explain and go on. Before it got dark we came upon a fair-sized waterhole, untouched by cattle or stock of any kind, and camped beside it for the night.
"Cripes! And wasn't she frightened?"
Dave will wonder.
"Not the least. Anyway, she didn't show it. See, the bush had been mother to Fay McGuire. Besides, Gongula kept an eye on her sleeping-place, lifting his head at intervals to see she was not disturbed. I can see that camp now. A solitary owl, I remember, looked down upon a lot of us from the branch of a withered tree, blinking in the dim light of the stars.
I seen him like that, round our cultivation," Joe will say.
"Oh, shut up!" And Dave, in reproval, will press his foot on Joe's. Joe will rescue it and kick out at Dave. Next morning we got going early and followed on till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when Fitzmaurice seemed to lose hope. Though he said little, he looked back at every turn. He seemed to be making calculations of the distance we had come, of the number of miles it was to the fringe of mulga that now lay behind far over the plain. To the rest of us, who gazed ahead in search of new objects, the gleaming stretches seemed to be dipping over a horizon that led to God knows where.
"Cripes!"
Dave,
leaning back from the table, will whisper to you, "Sam can tell it all right," but you'll nudge him to keep silent. As we trailed along, the horses suddenly made a bound and snorted. To our surprise, a calf staggered to its feet from the shade of a salt-bush. It had knocked up and been abandoned by the raiders. The poor little brute was famishing and hadn't long to live, and at sight of it we figured that that driven mob was not far off. As it staggered from horse to horse, mistaking them in turn for its mother, Fitzmaurice took out his revolver and looked meaningly at Fay Maguire. "It's the kindest thing to do, I suppose," she said.
"And did he shoot it, Sam?"
Joe will ask.
"Of course he did, you goat!"
Dave will snigger disrespectfully. Another hour and a hot wind blew up, the hottest I was ever in. You'd think it was coming out of a furnace. It seemed to finally decide Fitzmaurice, and suddenly he reined in. "It's madness, Miss Maguire," he said, "to go any further. We've scarcely any rations left, and if there's no grass and water on ahead, what's going to happen to the lot of us?" She put it to Kongula. "Cattle stealers know plenty of good country out here," he grinned, "or they wouldn't take big mob." Gongula was always logical. "But this mob might only be wandering off to Halifax," Fitzmaurice argued. "Cattle take those fits sometimes."
"Are you becoming afraid?" she asked, her brown eyes flashing. "If you are, I expect you can find your way home." "I'm not afraid," he protested, "but I'm not going to be a darn fool any longer either, not for all the cattle on earth."
With that he turned his horse and left us.
"Cripes! Went back on his own, eh?" from Dave.
"Yes, and Gongula and I went on with her to see it out."
"She was plucky all right," Joe decided.
"It's hard to believe a man could be such a cur," was all she said as we continued to run those tracks into the setting sun.
The wide plain now appeared to be coming to an end. Two pinnacles came in sight, and we could see that the country sloped away on either side of them into lightly timbered valleys. Gongula, pointing his whip-handle, grinned. Fay Maguire could only stammer a word or two in her excitement. Passing between these pinnacles, standing there like a natural gateway, we got the surprise of our lives. Before us, as far as we could see, were rich grasslands, with clumps of forest trees.
"What country is this, Gongula?"
Fay Maguire asked in wonder. But the half-caste was as much astonished as she. A little further on we reined in to gaze with amazement upon a lake, and all along it and out from it, cattle, cattle, sleek, fat, contented cattle. We hadn't gone above a mile further before Gongula cried out, pointing to a dozen head or so grazing quite near,
"Here, look, them been homestead bullocks, got 'em our brand, TM, look it." "So this is where they all are," Fay Maguire muttered, "the plant of cattle thieves." And all I could say was that I was damned.
We'd hardly recovered from the surprise when a well-mounted chap came riding leisurely across to us.
"Hello, you Billy Fitzmaurice," Gongula called to him. Then I gasped, "Mighty," for he was our head stockman's brother.
"Cripes!" Dave will break out. "So that was why the cow went back. He knew."
Then there will be an interruption. The doorway of your home will be darkened by a burly, bewhiskered figure standing in it, gazing on the group of you, and brandishing a green switch that he used as a riding whip.
"D-d-dad!"
Joe, looking up, will stutter, and turn attentively to Sam again. But Sam will be looking up, too.
"Cripes!" Dave will whine and protest to Dad. "You spoiled it coming in."
"So this is where you all are," Dad will roar, "with your heads together like sheep in a storm, hiding from the thunder and lightning, and a hundred of someone's pigs out there in your cultivation dig, spoiling your corn and pumpkins."
"Pigs!
And you foul Sam and the table in your haste to get out to the rescue.
and Sam and the others will follow to give you a hand.
End of chapter 11.